Coming up, Tim O'Brien outlines the controversial new abortion case the Supreme Court considers this coming week. And with record numbers of migrants still seeking refuge in Europe, many countries are putting severe new restrictions on who can come in. We look at the moral dimensions of the crisis. Plus, on the eve of the Academy Awards, the star of Son of Saul, which is up for Best Foreign Language Film, talks with David Tereshchuk about God and the Holocaust.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious groups have mixed reactions to President Obama's new plan to close the controversial U.S. military detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The plan calls for the remaining 91 detainees to be transferred to other countries or to a maximum security facility in the U.S. A decision on the location of the U.S. facility has yet to be made. Some religious leaders argued the president did not go far enough, since remaining detainees could be held indefinitely without charges or a trial. Others worried that the move would harm the nation's security. Pope Francis called on Catholic leaders to stop executions during this year that he has proclaimed a holy year of mercy. The Pope also said the death penalty should be permanently abolished. He said the commandment, "You shall not kill," refers to all, whether innocent or guilty. Francis's holy year of mercy encourages Catholics to show mercy in every aspect of their lives. Democratic hopeful Bernie Sanders this week said he believes Pope Francis is a socialist, just as he is. In an interview on a Catholic television program, Sanders praised the Pope's statements on wealth and economic inequality, but admitted they disagree on such issues as abortion. With Super Tuesday this coming week, religion continues to be a factor for many candidates. Hillary Clinton went to a church to speak out against gun violence. Republicans are still aggressively reaching out to evangelicals. Donald Trump pledged to be, quote, the greatest representative of the Christians they've had in a long time, unquote. That prompted a nun and a United Methodist bishop to accuse him in an op-ed piece of using faith as a ploy to grab votes. In another flap, Ted Cruz fired one of his staffers for falsely claiming on social media that Marco Rubio had mocked the Bible. The Archdiocese of St. Louis has urged that parishes cut ties with the Girl Scouts. In a letter to parishes, Archbishop Robert Carlson argued that the organization's beliefs are incompatible with Catholic values. Carlson said the Girl Scouts and the Church differ on issues such as reproductive rights and abortion. Carlson asked that churches seek alternative options to the Girl Scouts. The letter also voiced concerns about the Boy Scouts of America. Some Christian denominations have severed their relationship with that group because of gay rights issues. We have a Tim O'Brien story today about the Texas abortion case the Supreme Court is hearing on Wednesday. The Texas government says the 2013 law protects the health of the mother. Pro-choice groups say it's aimed at abolishing abortion rights.
The Texas abortion law, known as House Bill 2, was controversial from the start. Pro-choice lawmakers tried to filibuster the measure, and when it finally came to a vote, protesters had to be forcibly removed from the gallery. Anti-abortion forces are strong in Texas, and the measure passed easily.
In signing House Bill 2, today we celebrate and further cement the foundation on which the culture of life in Texas is built upon.
Among other things, the law requires that doctors performing abortions have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the procedure is performed, and that all abortions be performed in what's called an ambulatory surgical center, a sort of mini hospital. The avowed purpose of the law, to make abortions more safe. The law is being challenged by Whole Woman's Health, a chain of 5 abortion clinics, 3 in Texas, 2 in Virginia.
It sounds like the state has women's safety in their interest, but closing 3/4 of the clinics and requiring women to travel 500 miles for a 5-minute procedure, they don't have people's safety in mind. We've seen a spike in self-induction. We've seen a spike in women trying to do abortions on themselves. That is not in the best interest of women's health and safety.
The Supreme Court is a court of law, not facts. There are no witnesses here and no juries. The court examines a statute like the one in Texas to see if it is consistent with the Constitution. In most cases, the justices are bound by the facts in the lower court record. Here, however, those facts are in sharp dispute, both as to the purpose of the law and its effect. State Senator Ken Paxton was a driving force behind the law when it was passed in 2013. Today, Paxton is the Attorney General in Texas and is leading the effort to defend the Texas law in the Supreme Court.
Every week, 2 to 3 women have major complications from abortions. We have 10 a week that are in emergency rooms. We have 210 every year who have to be hospitalized. And so those are the women that we're worried about.
It's just not the case. Abortion is one of the safest medical procedures.
The abortion clinics will be represented by the New York-based Center for Reproductive Rights. Nancy Northup is its president.
In many cases, we have clinics who've gone 10 years, they haven't had one need to transfer a patient to a hospital for further care. So it's a way to sound like you're doing something safe for women, but really what you're doing is making women now not have a clinic in their neighborhood and have to go hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Every major city that has an abortion provider now will still have an abortion provider. That's not changing.
Every city that now has an abortion provider will still have an abortion.
Exactly.
We certainly don't get that from the other side.
Sure you don't, but that's the fact.
Well, it's not the case because clinics have closed in Beaumont, Texas, and Killeen, Texas, and the McAllen Clinic is on the verge of closing. We sued because El Paso would have to close. So it's not the case. In fact, we put a map in our Supreme Court brief that just shows how many clinics have closed already in Texas and how they're spread across the state, particularly outside of the major cities.
The clinic in San Antonio does have a surgery section, but the plaintiffs say many clinics cannot afford that and that it is unnecessary. And because most abortions are not performed in hospitals, most doctors specializing in abortion cannot get hospital admitting privileges. The Supreme Court is getting plenty of advice on how to decide this case in roughly 90 Friend of the Court briefs representing hundreds of organizations, including one filed jointly by the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, stating, "Abortion is an extremely safe medical procedure, and the Texas law imposes medically unnecessary demands on abortion facilities and serves no medical purpose." That echoes the findings of the trial judge, Lee Yackel, who concluded the Texas law creates a brutally effective system of abortion regulation, a statewide undue burden for substantial numbers of Texas women. All bewildering to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton.
I remember thinking when we were arguing for this, why the people that were pro-abortion, why they wouldn't be in favor of more significant standards or safer standards for women. If that's really the issue is women's health and women's safety and women, then I've never understood why that wouldn't be appealing to the other side.
Why isn't that appealing to you?
Oh, the provision of safe abortion services within communities is of great interest to the women's health movement, and we support that. But what we don't support is a kind of backhanded attempt to get rid of health care in communities by passing these unnecessary, regulations.
This is one of several high-profile cases that could be profoundly affected by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia last month. Scalia had been the court's most forceful critic of any constitutional right to choose abortion. The court had been split on abortion rights 4-4, with Justice Anthony Kennedy thought to hold the decisive fifth vote in this case. But with Scalia now gone, the court might end up equally divided, and the case may have to be re-argued at a much later date, after Scalia's successor is confirmed. Until then, this is a scenario that is likely to repeat itself over and over again on those politically charged and socially contentious issues that divide the court, as they do the country. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
Humanitarian officials say a ceasefire in Syria must take hold so that emergency aid can reach civilians who've been trapped amid escalating fighting. Some convoys have reached besieged areas, but tens of thousands of people are in desperate need. Meanwhile, according to a new report from the International Organization for Migration, so far in 2016, more than 100,000 asylum seekers from Syria, Iraq, North Africa, and other areas have traveled across the Mediterranean to Greece and Italy. Last year, the number didn't top 100,000 until June. Hoping to stem the tide, several European nations have begun placing severe new restrictions on their borders, leaving tens of thousands of migrants stranded. We want to talk more about the moral dimensions of this crisis. With me are our managing editor, Kim Lawton, Michelle Gaboudan, president of Refugees International, and Mark Smith, senior director for humanitarian emergencies at the Christian group World Vision. Welcome to each of you. Mark, let me begin with you. Looking at all the refugees, the millions of them, it seems hopeless. How do you avoid you and everybody you are working with, how do you avoid that?
I would say that our staff don't have that sense of hopelessness. I'd say there's frustration on their part, seeing the desperate plight of so many people. I think one of the things that we're in the business of doing is trying to bring hope to people who are hopeless themselves. Sometimes it's only temporary. Other times we're trying on longer term solutions, but I think our staff are really wanting to bring hope to people.
What are the moral obligations that not just your staff, but the international community has toward, you know, all of these people, Michelle?
Well, you know, at the end of the Second World War, to try to prevent the resurgence of the horrors we saw at the time, the Community of Nations did agree through a certain number of international instruments to be more generous to civilians caught in conflict. And the international humanitarian law was precisely trying to put some rules in how you conduct war and to protect civilians. These have been absolutely violated by the Assad regime, to a large extent by the Russians in indiscriminate bombings, to a lesser extent, but still by some of the other groups fighting there. And the second set of regulations was one to protect refugees. The Refugee Convention obliged a state to sign it to receive people who flee for their protection, and we are seeing in Europe, where almost all the countries signed that convention, that this is not how they are reacting at present. So we failed the Syrians.
Can anybody in these days and in the kinds of conditions that people are in, can anybody abide by rules?
Yes, they should, and we think they should.
Well, maybe
and
they
a
should,
lot of our advocacy efforts are focused on trying to pressure, you know, the actors in the region to abide by international humanitarian norms and laws.
But what are the ethical, you know, moral obligations of these countries to the people in their countries who say, we're overwhelmed, all these people are taking resources from us? You know, how do they balance those questions?
Well, I think you're making an important point, is that the countries neighboring Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, have been extremely generous to the refugees. When they started fleeing, they kept their borders open, etc. But they're bursting at the seams now, and that's why we see people moving out. I think perhaps where we have failed is not to give sufficient support to these countries, not only in humanitarian aid, but also in serious development aid, so that the host communities would feel that the world was sharing the burden. And that's a feeling they don't have.
And what about in Europe?
Well, in Europe, they're facing a crisis that, to a certain degree, is a part of international making, in that, you know, as Michelle has mentioned, if there's not enough aid for the countries immediately surrounding Syria, you're starting to see a movement of people into the European theater. And they're now dealing with this. Unfortunately, a lot of these countries are making decisions that are not necessarily best for the people who are coming in, but rather kind of serving their own interests.
If the international, if everybody doesn't do more
right,
right now, the dangers to children growing up, to
Absolutely.
People who have no jobs, are tremendous and dangerous to everybody around them. Right.
Right? One of the things that you know, we have really wanted to focus on in terms of messaging, and you know, Refugees International, World Vision, and others are part of an initiative called No Lost Generation, because one of the things that we are really concerned about is losing an entire generation of children. You know, the Syrian children, I mean, the numbers are staggering in terms of, you know, 44% of, or drop in 44% of enrolled school children. We're seeing, you know, 17% of children who are in camp or outside of camps, only 17% are attending school. And so you're losing potentially a generation of children.
And what are the responsibilities of the U.S.? You know, we talk about the immediate countries in Europe. What about for us, briefly?
Well, the U.S. has been the leader in terms of responding to the emergency through the funding of the humanitarian agencies. We have
yes.
to recognize that. However, the total funding remains at 60% of needs. So we need to do much more. And the U.S., I know, is trying to get more donors to come to the table. We hope they'll succeed in that, but we also would like to see more from the U.S. in that. And the second point where the U.S. could help right now is in helping with what we would call an orderly departure from Turkey, from Jordan, and from Lebanon through a series of means. Can be resettlement, can be student grants, can be family reunification. There are all kinds of ways to try to help people living orderly in an orderly manner.
Michelle, our time is up, I'm sorry to say. Thanks to you, Michelle. Thanks to Mark of World Vision. And thanks to Kim Lawton of this program. On our calendar this coming week, members of the Baha'i faith prepare spiritually for their new year with a 19-day fast to set aside time for prayer and meditation. There are approximately 5 million Baha'is around the world. The Academy Awards are Sunday night, always an occasion for celebration. But this year, as David Tereshchuk reports, one of the nominees for Best Film in a Foreign Language is Son of Saul, a powerful story of the Holocaust. The lead actor is a Hungarian Jew who asks, where was God when so many Jews were killed?
We are talking about the heart of Europe. In the middle of the 20th century, with the cooperation of lawyers and doctors and architects and the clergy, in front of their very own eyes, 10,000 of images of God were gassed and burned every day in Auschwitz.
The fundamental question of human evil is addressed in Son of Saul, the international movie debut of Geza Rorick. But he's no ordinary actor among Oscar contenders. He plays the main character in this death camp film, but he's primarily a poet, novelist, and teacher, and most of all, an Orthodox Jew. Rorick was adopted as a child by a Hungarian Jewish couple whose relatives were murdered by the Nazis. In his late teens, Rorick intensively studied the Holocaust, including making an extended visit to Auschwitz.
Immediately I had a sense that I felt like I belong there. And, you know, started to examine this very strong reaction of mine. Why is that? Why can't I just, you know, let go and go back to the train station? I rented a room and I came back for a month. There's a lot of unburied dead people there. It's the largest cemetery of Jews. Every third victim in Auschwitz was Hungarian.
Rorick's character in the film, Saul, is a member of the Sonderkommando, groups of Jewish prisoners forced to herd their fellow Jews into the gas chambers. and dispose of their remains as part of the Nazis' industrial process of extermination.
I really think that the most demonic aspect of Nazism was exactly this sort of division of labor, to leave the dirty work of the Holocaust to the victims themselves, let them burn their brothers and sisters, and by doing that, their innocence were taken away from them. They were kind of dragged down to the rock bottom of the morality of the perpetrators.
Saul feels suddenly compelled to ensure that at least one person gets a proper ritual burial, a young boy. He has surprisingly survived the gassing, but only for a short while. Now that he's dead, Saul wants first to save his body from being dissected by the camp doctors.
His pursuit is to bury this one. He can't bury them all, but he's going to bury this one. It's his job. It's his purpose from now on. That's what keeps him alive. I always defend Saul. Other people walk up to me after screenings and they say, this guy is a fool, he's an idiot. What difference does it make to bury one boy when there are so many goes to the oven? And I say, listen, so just because something is impractical, it doesn't mean it's not important or even not substantial. So for Saul, this was absolutely paramount to make sure that this one is buried. And I think it's beautiful.
For the burial he somehow hopes to achieve, Saul needs to find a rabbi among his fellow Sonderkommando, someone who will know the Jewish burial rituals. Rurik, like many others, has wrestled with how a loving God could have allowed the Holocaust to happen at all. But he didn't lose his faith, at least not his faith in God.
I lost faith in man. I have a moral necessity to believe. And if I couldn't believe in man, that kind of led me to believe in God.
Rurik looked to the Torah story of how Abraham, or Avraham, angrily questioned God.
And Avraham, when he's trying to negotiate about the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah, he says, "Kol ha-shofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Will the judge of the whole world will not do justice? How can you destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Whenever I came across an argument against God, I always found a counter-argument for God. It eventually comes down to the question who you are. If by believing you are more you, then you have to believe. And I am more myself believing. I'm kind of disoriented if I try to take a position that would deny the existence of God, because that's not who I am.
So for you, where was God in the death camps?
I believe that God was right in the middle of it. God was not abandoning his people. I think we are given free choice, and God was suffering along, you know, with everybody else who were suffering there. I think that he escorted us all the way.
Even into the gas chambers?
Yes. If I wouldn't believe that 1.5 million Jewish children who were, you know, were murdered upon arrival, then I would have no choice but spit God into his face. There is no other way for me to put make this case of God unless I believe that he was there.
Rurik fears future generations will not be emotionally connected to the Holocaust.
The younger generations, they go to Auschwitz and they do selfies. It's not a lack of knowledge. These kids don't deny it happened. They all know this 6 million, they all know it's gas. But they don't feel it.
71 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, though, Rurik does not feel hopeful.
I don't think history turned the page. I think genocide is a permanent possibility. And I thought the bloodiest possible century is just behind us. The 21st must be much better. Well, 15 years into the 21st, it doesn't seem very promising.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Tereshchuk reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, scenes from a festival in Sri Lanka, where decorated elephants escorted a casket which many believe contains a relic of Buddha.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.